Welcome to WNHH Radio's Dateline New Haven. I'm your host, Paul Bass, inviting you to join me on an exploration of what makes Elm City and Connecticut tick. It's not Mayor Monday, folks. Mayor Tony Harp is at a conference in Boston. She plans to rejoin us next week for her usual check-in on what's happening in our city. In her stead, we have two political movers and shakers in the studio, neck deep in this year's hotly contested statewide election campaigns. Say good morning to J.R. Romano, Connecticut State Republican Party Chairman, and New Haven Democratic State Rep, Roland Lamar. And Roland, what's your position with the party in general for the elections?
I'm actually working on a number of campaigns without an official title, but the chair of the House Dems campaign committee the last cycle.
But not this cycle?
Not this cycle.
Okay. And welcome back to WNHH, gentlemen. Thanks so much for showing up.
Thank you for having us.
Good morning, Paul.
All right. So tonight, Monday night, unless you're hearing this in a rerun, New Haven is hosting the debate of the Republican candidates for governor.
Should be exciting.
I'm looking forward. I'm going to be there.
Awesome. I'll see you there.
Yeah, it's going to be at the Schubert Theater. And then afterwards, we'll get you in the spin room, because they do have a spin room. And you get to tell us that everything we saw, we didn't just see.
Depends.
So, Roland Lamar, if the Republicans had brought you to be the questioner tonight at this debate, what would you ask Mark Boughton, Stefanoski? How do you say the guy? Stemmerman?
David Stemmerman.
David Stemmerman, Mark Boughton, and who's the fourth one? Steve Obsidnik.
Yeah. I'd ask them, what does Connecticut in 2025 look like? You know, because frankly, that's all I'd ask them. Like, paint that actual picture.
You got off easy, JR.
No, because the reality is people want to like relitigate the 70s, 80s, 90s, early 2000s.
Oh, in other words, you don't want them to talk about all the years Democrats are in charge.
Well, if they can, if they want to, just like we can sit here and focus on former Governor John Rowland, or we can focus on former Governor Jody Rell and what they did and didn't do. We can talk about all of this stuff that put us in this position. I think we've covered that ground over the last few cycles. What we need, what the state desperately needs, is a vision for Connecticut in the out years and show us how to get there. I'll take the blame. I'll sit here on this radio station. I'll go anywhere you want.
Or you'd rather that went to the Republicans than to Ned Lamont.
I want both of them. I want each party to actually have that vision in place right now. Paint that picture for the next 6 months. Tell us how we get to a point where our state's growing jobs, growing our economy, our cities are vibrant, and our schools are second class. I mean, second to none in the country. And I think that vision would be popular. I think it would cut across a political divide. And I think you'd actually have a robust conversation. Otherwise, we're just going to see tens of millions of dollars of mailers and negative campaigns and, you know, 30-second mugshots on TV screens at both parties. And
so, Roland, since you mentioned that, I'm being so high-ranking within the House Democrats, does that mean that you're not going to send out negative mailers attacking every Republican? I mean, I find that kind of funny. But in terms of the vision for the state, you know, it's actually quite simple. The fundamental problem is Democrats don't want to buy into another possible solution to the disaster that they've created, right? So you want to talk about 2025. I'm glad you brought that up. We're still going to be stuck with a CBAC deal that's crushing our unfunded liability.
That's the state unions.
Yeah, I mean,
look,
you can't kind of say, in this grandiose kind of approach, to say, what's it going to look like? Yeah, great, okay, but the devil's in the details. How do we get there? And if we elect Republicans, what I can tell you is that in 2025, our state's going to be in much better shape than we are today. We're losing jobs, we're losing population, taxes are on the rise, cost of living's on the rise. Those are just facts. And the reality is we need new leadership in Hartford that's going to take us into a different direction that can accomplish a better Connecticut. Because all we're hearing today are the same exact things that got us into this situation. Ned Lamont talked about hiring taxes. We're talking about tolls. We're talking about all these things that mean more revenue for the state without honestly talking about the way you guys spend money.
You say hiring taxes?
Raising taxes.
Oh, H-I-G-H-E-R-I-N-G. Yeah. Roland, what do you think? JR came out pretty strong there. What do you think?
No, I mean, and I get this. Like, if you want to crystallize a political conversation about the future of our state into what you can put into a 30-second soundbite, you will talk about labor deals in an uninformed way, like we just heard.
What's uninformed? Is it the best deal in the entire country for any state employee or federal employee? Is it the best deal?
I have no idea. I have not evaluated each individual deal coming into this, but
what's wrong with paying people well and letting them retire?
Well, but it because it's beyond that. Because when you look at the fact that Dick Blumenthal, right, who's a senator, he opts out of congressional federal benefits because what we give him here as a retiree is better. So we are fundamentally, what we're doing is we're going above and beyond.
Well, JR, we're at a time when a lot of Republican governors have been cutting back union rights and benefits so much that teachers in your red states are demonstrating against you because they feared they can't even afford to teach anymore. What's wrong with holding the line on benefits that let you
Well, but what we're asking for is to contribute retire. More. Right? We're not sitting here saying that, first of all, what we have to talk about is future hires. And that's fundamentally off the table for a lot of these negotiations. We're asking for employees to contribute the same that private citizens contribute to a 401k. Because
they have to contribute too much. Most people can't afford to retire as a result. So, and their health care is out of control.
But what you're fundamentally asking is the average family in Connecticut that isn't a state employee to contribute more to someone else's retirement when they're struggling on their from themselves. That's where people are leaving here.
So we have to be honest about the liability here.
Right.
Well, let's be honest. State employment is down about 20% in the year since Governor Malloy, myself, all elected in 2011. State employment's down about 20%. We renegotiated those state contracts numerous times. A substantially better deal
billions and billions of dollars
in the out years. We have renegotiated all future hires, having less robust retirement plans, demanding more in the way of contributions across the board. And let me tell you about what actually drives up state costs. It is the fact that the original architect of 401k plans in this country will come out and say it was never supposed to work like this. It was never supposed to be the sole source of retirement income. The state of Connecticut and states across this country are seeing an explosion of additional dollars going out, outflow of dollars going to, you know, support people buying home heating fuel, supporting senior elder care, health home cares, trying to figure out ways to care for our aging population, because the retirement structure that we had in place that supported generations and generations of Americans was swept out from underneath their feet.
So you're not talking about public benefits at this point. You're talking about the rise of 401k.
The rise of 401k is the reliance
on fewer employer.
Yeah, the reliance on that method is putting more and more people in poverty in their older years. And the state of Connecticut is forced.
But wait a second, before you guys go further, I don't think Roland responded to JR's point. I think JR's point, if I'm not mistaken, is that because we are not doing this race to the bottom with benefits, as I'm characterizing, you're not characterizing as that, to be fair, that we can't afford the benefit plan of the unions, that even with the give backs, we have a more generous plan than other states, and it has us locked into so much debt that both parties contributed to over the years.
You're not getting an argument. I'm not, but the reality is we're here.
So what should we do about it? We have
an agreement. We need to go to a 401k model where with new hires are not in this program that's basically bankrupting the state. And Roland,
the people who've been employed by the state of Connecticut, hired into the state of the Connecticut over the last 15 years, their pension fund is completely solvent.
It is true that the bulk is, I forget the name for it, but the people who have already been retired for quite a while.
Let me ask you a question then. Yeah. But there's small things that you guys continue to do that continue to drive up our liability. And you're seeing the reports today. CT Mirror just released a report that we're talking about $1 billion of unfunded liability, and it's almost impossible to solve the crisis that we're in. Connecticut Mirror, which is a great nonprofit organization, has been calling you guys out for this stuff. Sure. For months, okay? And the fundamental problem that I have is you are not being realistic where the Connecticut economy is and how we're going to pay for these unfunded liabilities. And I find it very interesting that you talked about where Americans are retiring today and fundamentally how they're struggling, right? But also what we have to be honest with ourselves in terms of what were the savings rates? What was the consumer rate? How much debt did people take on in buying things that they couldn't afford, and then they get stuck and trapped? In 2007, 2009, when our economy was crumbling, people went well beyond their means, and they got a lot of people in trouble. There's no question that there are people in this country that are suffering, and we need to figure out how to help them. But don't sit here and say that it was because of 401ks. It had a lot to do with a lot of people not saving enough money, a lot of people who were not necessarily looking at their future in that regard. And that's just a fact. You can go back and look at saving rates.
A quick reply about saving rates and 401k dollars, where they would have been had people been saving into them for the 80s and 90s and 2000s at the rate he wanted, they would have lost it all in 2007 and 2009 during the Wall Street-based financial recession.
That's a fundamental disagreement about market-based solutions, right? So people on my side would say that we shouldn't trust retirement to the private market. People on your side say that becomes more efficient because the market is more efficient. You could do it at lower cost, correct?
But fundamentally, I don't think Roland is kind of acknowledging is the savings rates. And to your point, if someone retired in 2009, yeah, that was bad. But a vast majority of people have made back including my mother, who was fortunate enough to retire in the last 5 years, have made back in their investments.
Why hasn't the state now? This was Republican governors and Democratic legislators for years when the economy was doing better, did not put enough into pensions. Not,
well, but with all due respect, it wasn't Republican governors. They can't act unilaterally. They needed the legislature.
But this was a deal together. It wasn't John Rowland and Jody Rell saying
the governors could act unilaterally in determining the relationships with our unionized workforce.
He's asking a very specific question about funding the teachers. And
couldn't they have vetoed it if they weren't part? They were part and parcel of those deals. Rell and Rowland were part and parcel of those deals.
Wait a minute. Time out. You're acting as though the Democrats didn't have a veto-proof majority. You're acting as though they had veto-proof majorities in those times. They did.
A very brief window.
Not the Rell year and not the Rowland year when this was done.
The veto-proof majorities
were
in 2004. They were veto-proof. And in 2006, they were veto-proof. They had 4 years where they were 100% veto-proof. The only reason that I know that is because I ran in 2004 and the House went down to 38 members in the Republican Party. That's veto-proof, right? Those were the Rell years. Okay, so at the end of the day, over all this jockeying, over all the Democrats blustering about how we need to take care of workers, the legislature never acted. And Roland, you weren't there, but the truth is, Martin Luney was there. They never acted. In fact, I'll never forget this. In 2004, the Republicans introduced legislation to basically make it mandatory to fill to backfill the teachers' pension retirement fill, and Bill Anaskovich was involved in that. And the only reason that
Republican
I remember
from the shoreline.
Right. And the only reason I remember that is because my mother, who was a teacher, got a letter where the teachers union was condemning Bill Anaskovich. And he was like, I introduced this legislation to basically try to make the teachers pen solvent. And the teachers union attacked him anyway.
So Jay Ramon and Roland Lamar, separate from these issues about who's responsible, what would you do now to deal with our crushing pension debt?
Well, there's two things. We have to, I think, cut. I think we have to be strategic in how we're being, and in many of these cases, it's small amounts that could add up to a lot. I mean, you saw, for example, UConn, and I know that this is state law from the 70s, but spent $437,000 on a mural. I mean, and that's just one example of
how. You're against public art?
I'm not against public art, but what I'm against is the fact that when we can't pay teachers, when we have people that are leaving the state, we have to make a decision what we need to invest in now.
So you would invest more in the pension fund by making selective cuts?
Well, looking at where we can cut.
How much more a year? How much a year?
Well, you got to go through agency after agency and look at those. I mean, by the way, that mural, to me, is one of the most egregious because you're paying for a licensing fee for a dead artist, where they could have hired someone at a much lower rate to do something more creative. Someone
so
who's
how
alive.
Much money a year would you pump into pensions more than they're doing now?
Oh, I mean, for as a catch-up, they have to almost double. We're talking about $1 billion liability. The article.
So how much more a year should we?
It's astronomical. I wouldn't even be able to tell you.
Roland?
Yeah, no, I think we have to segregate the different funds so we don't conflate these issues and like misrepresent reality here. The last few generations of public sector employees, their pension funds, their pension plans are fully funded and completely solvent. We're talking about tier one, tier 1A, people who were retired a number of years ago, folks who've got 40, 50 years of service, who are still working for the state, folks that we cannot collect generally another dime from because they're already retired. And the folks who've come into state employment over the last 20 years have been subsidizing that fund as well as their own,
a Ponzi scheme,
which is fully solvent. So what we need to do is segregate those funds out, deal directly with Tier 1 and Tier 1A by having a dedicated revenue source that's different, that cannot be...
How much more money a year?
It is north of $1 billion per year.
So you think we need to spend $1 billion more, maybe something we both agree on that we're spending now to shore up that pension fund so we don't have balloon payments? Is that correct? That'll cripple us 15 years down the line?
And fundamentally, I think the other problem that the management, particularly over the last 8 years with Dan Mulway and the Democrats, is they've been borrowing for things that they shouldn't be, unnecessary things. And so if we were to try to borrow money, which I'm not a big fan of in order to solve the pension problem, we're maxed out. Our credit card's maxed out.
But you just said it. No one responsible would borrow. I know that city governments
I agree with you, but if we're talking about a teacher or a state employee not being able to eat, I mean, we have to be able to evaluate those situations.
Two teachers who can't eat in 10 years.
Well,
making a Republican argument here, Jay.
I understand that, but there's a compassion here to understand that we can't be having people starving in the streets, not being able to pay their mortgage payment in retirement. I get that.
So, Roland, you said dedicated revenue stream to put $1 billion more toward the Tier 1 pensions. Where would that revenue stream come from?
There are a series of creative sort of new financing systems across the country that other states use. Like we talk about what our tax obligations, tax rates are, and evaluate them versus what other states do. And what other states have become proficient in is finding like public utility fees or public service fees or other mechanisms, other fee structures.
Well, it's got to come somewhere. You're talking about raising taxes, talking about fees utilities.
It would be either utility fees or
other tax forms.
We don't have a lot of that. With most other states, what they use to fund...
We have the highest gas tax. One of the highest gas taxes.
We don't. We're mid-tier on gas taxes.
We are less than Massachusetts and New York, aren't we?
We're like in the top five, number one. And what about utility costs? Don't we have some of the highest utility costs in the country, too, because
that would just be passed along to customers?
Everything gets passed along. What other states do is utilize those mechanisms to generate additional revenues outside of their conventional income.
Well, we're doing that already. That's why I guess the point that I'm bringing up.
Where would you find the money to put $1 billion? You say you'd cut. You gave a 1 year, one mural that you would, instead of $400,000.
I think we have to massively go through what currently the state government's spending.
But you've been looking at the state government for a long time, JR. Give me some examples.
I just gave one, the arts program.
You gave me a one-time one example that's fine, $430,000. But how are you going to get $1 billion
Wait a minute, time out. That number is of one project. There's another $3 million of RFQ'd projects that are going to be paid for.
Qualifications.
Yeah, that haven't been done yet. I mean, that's just one project. So there are all of these other government agencies and entities. We need to evaluate where we can cut there. And then ultimately...
So basically, you're both agreeing that we need to put big money into the Tier 1 pension fund. JR says cut. Roland says find new revenue streams.
Well, wait. In cutting and making the government more efficient, and hopefully, instead of raising taxes, we create an economy and an environment where businesses actually want to come here and not be paid to come here, which is two different things, but actually come here. And then all of a sudden, what happens is if we start having people that are earning higher incomes... higher income tax, you start to generate tax revenue without having to raise taxes, but you're growing the economy.
That's the one place you guys fundamentally disagree, because everyone agrees, with this pre-shows, everyone agrees we want to have more jobs, more companies coming here. Most people agree, I think, to both of you, that you shouldn't do like the big six programs where you pay them to come. But Roland would argue that the reason we lost companies like GE and Alexion is that we don't invest public money in an environment where we have more of a tech sector, more education, better infrastructure. And you would argue
it's been mismanaged, that
the programs have been mismanaged and that higher taxes drove people out of state. Isn't that the fundamental disagreement between you two?
I think that is a huge disagreement between the two.
But I mean, a fair way of putting it.
Yeah.
And another fair way to put it is that J.R. Romano is the state Republican chairman of Connecticut, and Roland Lamar is the untitled man behind many of the Democratic campaigns this year, and he's a state rep from New Haven, and they're here on Dateline New Haven. Kate Rosen says, I love when you have these two on. I agree with you, Kate. It is one of my most fun shows to do. Haji Bey Kachatabalshalu gives you the thumbs up. And there are a few, Harry Jarosz's Great Debate and a few other thumbs up. Thanks, everybody, for listening. So we
it
have
helps. JR and I generally like each other. We have a very similar like personal background.
And you're like 10 times, and you guys are 10 times as interesting as everyone left running for governor.
I think that's probably
right.
So I have
to tell you that if you're going to be sleeping tonight during this debate, you could turn down the volume of Channel 8, re-listen to the show, and turn up, which really raises a question for you guys. You guys have run campaigns. Why are both of your parties trying so hard to lose these elections this year? We have all these top offices are open. And your party so far has spent the last few months trying to get rid of every candidate who could appeal to people who from the other party or independents. There are more than 800,000 independents in Connecticut. Almost twice
You're
as many
have to be
independents
more specific.
As Republicans. I will be. Almost twice as many independents as Republicans. A couple hundred thousand more independents than Democrats. And here you had on the Republican Party, and I don't know her. I have no idea if she's great or terrible. But you had a 31-year-old woman who's a Republican who wins office in New Britain, a Democratic city, gets Latino votes, and understands social media, that except for JR is the only Republican who understands you go on Facebook Live to do what you're doing. I mean, I don't know a Democrat who thought she could be beaten for governor. And she didn't even make her 15%. You're even trying to make
actually, she decided to run for lieutenant governor.
Because she didn't have the support. There was a jihad, JR, in your, and I'm going to get to the Democrats too. There was a jihad in the Republican Party to make sure this woman who wasn't considered pure enough for the hardcore hate women Republicans, Kevin
time
Rennie
out,
went
time
after
out, time
her.
Time out, time out, time out, time out. First of all, that's a complete, like that is completely unfounded, this idea that the hate women Republicans, because we also have people like Themis Claridis, we had Jody Rell, we had tremendous female, in fact, we have more elected women than the Democrats.
Clarity, why wasn't Themis Claridis running? Because she wants to run the legislature.
Okay. Well, so fundamentally, I think...
But both you guys are putting these like boring, rich, white guys who never ran anything in government thinking they're going to buy this office.
Well, first of all, I don't, right? There was a convention...
I know you want Tim Hertz.
I literally just create the playing field, they play the game. Right. So, but understand this.
But don't you want to win? I mean, how could you not have had Aaron Stewart running for governor?
Well, but I'm gonna explain. Here's what I think. Aaron, basically, because she's running New Britain, got into the race very late. Every other candidate had been running for a year, pledging people who were pledging their support for the year. And say what you want about Republicans, but when it comes to these things, and I wouldn't know. I'm sure Democrats are the same. When they say I'm with you, and someone else comes along, they're staying with you. And that's kind of what fundamentally.
And that's
a good
point. Again, I don't know Aaron Stewart. I don't know. Like, I know Chris Powell just attacked her. This because she went out and fairly about how she didn't have answers on pensions. Kevin Rennie, I think, just couldn't stand the idea of a woman there. But in any case, I think your point's well taken about that. But why wouldn't the Republicans want to win? I
mean, we are going to win.
But JR, you know that you have the most unpopular governor in the country.
Absolutely.
And you had this feeling in America that people want to get rid of the kind of old kind of people running for office. They want fresh, young faces, people who could appeal across lines and independents. How could you have blown that opportunity?
Yeah, but again, I think it has a lot to do with when you're talking about Aaron, unfortunately, because she's the mayor of New Britain and was running that city efficiently and so well, she decided and pondered a lot longer than some of the other candidates and got into the race late. And I think there were people who were already committed, and that's fundamentally what happened.
Man, you are so ready for the spin room tonight. I think they should import you for the national debates in 2 years. Roland Lamar, what about you guys? I mean, we don't have to say this on the air, but you know you've been going and like stuck in your head in the pillow every night and wondering what the hell happened to your party. How did you end up with Ned Lamont, a guy who all he's ever done is lost the race 12 years ago that all the people who backed him then have since left him because he wants to self-finance all his campaigns, puts everyone to sleep, has no experience running government, and you had this amazing field. You had Jonathan Harris, who was like, definitely would have gotten a lot of independence. I really knew how to run a state. You had some other smart candidates. How did that happen?
I think we saw incredible interest early on. We saw the 2016 election happen. So 2015, 2016, you had a number of Democrats who were seeing, you know, an opportunity that they were going to run. They were going to be the next Connecticut governor. They were going to usher in this vision that I've been talking about, 2025. How do we get there? What are the strong choices? People were having that conversation. You saw the Trump wave of 2016. And you saw sort of a number of Democrats say, I do not want to be in government in this environment. We had a series of top tier candidates who expressed interest early on. I was really excited about Kevin Lembo, for example.
Yeah, I guess they just felt they couldn't win, right?
They felt they couldn't win. I was excited about Nancy Wyman. I was excited by...
Lembo would have been a strong candidate.
Right. There were a number of candidates that I thought had both the talent, the passion, and the vision to move forward. I was sticking with Senator Winfield for a very long time, hoping he would reevaluate the choice that
he even
made
got shoved out of the lieutenant governor race.
Yeah. So I think like we have to come together as a party after these primaries are done, and we have to create that vision. Where I think Ned struggles is in captivating people around
him.
He's
buying the race. What kind of Democrats can in good conscience support a guy with no experience who wants to buy a race when he keeps losing? That's what the Republicans, now JR, to be fair, that's what the Republicans have been doing for the last two governor races and last two Senate races.
Don't think that I haven't compiled every tweet, every comment that the Democrats have made about Tom Foley and Linda McMahon, because we're just going
to
put it right back up and
highlight
the hypocrisy.
I mean, yes, the substance of the issues matter. It matters about whether you believe in self-financing campaigns when you have and trying to buy the office, which, by the way, two of the Republicans are trying to do, as well as Ned Lamont. So that, but there's also like it doesn't work in Connecticut. Linda McMahon spent $50 million each time, and I thought she had some positives as a candidate, and like she still couldn't win with $50 million. Had strong opponents, but Foley was running against this monumentally unpopular governor. He was an unobjectionable individual, and he couldn't win putting that kind of money in. What makes you think Ned Lamont or Stemmerman or
Stemmerman, and we still have a primary of five candidates. The Democrats have coalesced behind Ned, so there's a very different conversation.
Although, would you agree with me now, the most interesting candidate in either party is the one who Democrats, a lot of leading Democrats, hope doesn't emerge, which is Joe Ganim. He's the mayor of Bridgeport. He's the only one who has been colorful to all this whole process. I don't know if you guys saw the video last week when he got barred, which I still can't understand why your parties do this. You had a governor debate But they said, not only does public TV want to put everyone to sleep by having only the most boring candidates left debating, they wouldn't let Joe Ganim, who's already gotten twice as many signatures to get on the ballot, or some of the other Republicans appear on this forum. So we had this great video, went on for 8 minutes, where in front of all the reporters, this person from the Rail Center comes out and tells them.
I was there. I actually had a ticket for Joe in case they didn't let him in. That's true.
He can't answer questions from reporters outside a debate. They're working that hard to make sure somebody else doesn't get heard. Then they told him they can't come in because they're worried he's going to talk to a reporter. Roland, how does this make your party look?
Yeah, no, I mean, look, I desperately hope that Joe Ganim does not become governor. He does not become a party
because
nominee.
He spent 7 years in jail for corruption. I don't see how 800,000 he's going to get.
And I don't think he's engaged in
the
level of accountability and personal responsibility in talking about what he did and how he's grown in that time. I don't think he's evidenced enough growth personally or professionally in the short period of time to demonstrate that he can be an effective governor. At this point, I think, he's got to be invited in.
But
he's got to have him make his case.
But you think
he's a petitioning candidate right now. So we should treat him as a petitioning Democratic candidate. He should, make his case, make it strongly. I'm not signing his petition.
But how do we get to the point where someone who spent 7 years in jail and would probably, according to mainstream Democrats, have like no chance to barely break 20%. How does he emerge as the most sympathetic character in either party in this campaign now? When he's getting shutting out of debates, he's getting people interested in his campaign. How did this happen? And how could people not root
for
someone?
But as someone who's a party leader, I'm going to say exactly what happened. So in my case, everyone kept saying to me, you need to make your field smaller. You need to make your field smaller. And I refused. I basically let it all play out. I invited the candidates. I set up a criteria that they had to meet. And if you were in the criteria, great. And I caught a lot of flack. There was Aaron Stewart didn't raise enough money for one of the debates, that kind of thing. But I think in the point of what's happening with Joan.
Why did she get kicked out of debates? That might have helped her.
Well, because she didn't raise enough money. There was a threshold that was created because
so
you got to understand,
the money
too, there's
too.
Other people out there that sign up to run for governor who, if you invite this one who's fit. So we had to create.
And you did have like about 20.
Right. So I had to create a criteria that you had to meet.
I'm still trying to get Stemmerman and Stefanowski.
Good luck.
I'm still trying to get them separated in my mind.
But
which hedge fund guy is which? Yeah.
But I think by saying to Joe specifically, you're not allowed, you're feeding oxygen into the fire, right? You're giving him the attention he needs and craves to be the outsider candidate. And
I have to say, watching him on stage, and the Democrats still had a lot of candidates when he was in New Haven, I really felt he's the only person up there who looked like he can run a government.
And I got to be honest with you, Paul.
He was pretty
part of it
there,
is
Roland.
He's the only person for a long period of time. He was the only person that seemed like a real person who could tell a real story that people related to.
No question.
Independent of like what he did that got him in prison,
in
which we should not easily excuse.
Right, but
we
black voters particularly really respond to this idea of a second chance.
Right. Yeah, and I don't know that
he should
be the poster boy
case.
For that, but he's like a real person. You have him in this room. You have him like at your kitchen table. You have him anywhere on the streets of New Haven or Hartford.
And by the way, Mark Boughton is too.
And like, and that's like, as a Democrat, I worry about Mark Boughton be the nominee because he actually has that level of connectedness.
And he's run. The other thing is like people run something. This whole trend in government now in both of your parties is that people want outsiders, fine, but they also end up with these people who never ran anything like Foley in government. They always feel like because I ran a business, I can run government.
All of the candidates, though, and I'll say this even to the Democrats, are outsiders. What to me, an outsider is someone that, no offense, isn't in Hartford. Mayors and first selectmen do not.
But what's wrong with being in Hartford and knowing how it runs so that you can make things happen?
Because it's not happening well right now. Right? It's like saying the company's running great. It's
so you
not.
Want Ned Lamont in there to like run the thing?
No, but no. What I'm saying, though, is every one of these candidates is an outsider. Whether it's a mayor, first selectman, or a businessman, they're all outsiders.
But
in
their businesses, do they want people like running a cable TV company who never figured out where wires go?
Well, the voters are going to make that decision, right? I will say this, though, and the idea of Joe Gannon getting a second chance, and I said this when he ran for mayor, and we need to remind the listeners that there's, and I grew up in Derby, right? So there's lots of people who have brushes with the law. And a lot of times it's centered around trying to feed a family, trying to, put food on the table, pay for
you
rent.
Think that was the Joe Ganim case?
No, that's exactly my point is that this is a guy that stole because he wanted a BMW, not a Lexus, right? That is not the case for Joe. And this idea
he's
like,
good on the soundbite.
No, that is really good.
That's a good line about the BMW
right.
Lexus.
Like, yeah. I mean, people relate to him because he has a real story. He has a real personality. You can engage with him. He's funny. Like there's a lot of
when I watch
about
him for 8 minutes being told he can't even walk into a debate, let alone get on the stage, let alone answer a question from reporters outside of a building that's supposed to be dedicated to discussion of issues. How could you not root for that?
Well, and all I was standing there. If she said to him, "We're not going to let you in," I had tickets in my pocket. I was going to hand him a ticket.
JR, as the Republican state chairman, is going to help Joe Ghanem do as well as he can in Democratic primary. What do you think about that?
I'm certain he is.
Well, you know, Democrats would make him felt that way about Donald Trump in 2016. They thought this guy's a disaster for the Republican Party. And, you know, he seems to be connecting with people. Let's hope he does as well as he can to destroy the party. We know how well that went. So, folks, JR and Roland, in 2018, there's a big election in Connecticut this year. How are those two figures going to play, Donald Trump and Dan Malloy? Obviously, JR, you're trying to say Dan Malloy. He's run the state into the ground. Roland, you are very involved with grassroots groups who are trying to harness the distaste for Donald Trump into a local turnout. Which person is going to be more of a motivating factor for the other side?
I think right now Donald Trump is more of a motivating factor for Democrats, largely because we've seen what a level of inexperience, anti-government, Connecticut values will look like. And when you see a number of Republican candidates, Timmy Herbst, for example, is the best
example. Trumbull first selectman. He's running as the Trump candidate.
Yeah, former Trumbull first selectman. And you go into the hilarious things, you go into Trumbull and you listen to people talk about him. They have this experience as if he was a mini Trump because he was so.
Democrats.
Yeah, Democrats and Republicans generally just see this guy as bombastic. And
I've actually heard Republicans tell me they're quitting the party if he, like old fashioned Connecticut Republicans, if Herbst is the.
He's bombastic. He's involved in multiple family lawsuits and personal lawsuits and, you know, using, you know, federal government, it's town government to exercise personal demons. He says ridiculous, outrageous things on purpose to get attention. He calls himself the mini Trump, right? Like 2 years ago, he was running for treasurer. He was essentially using
that as like Chris Christie. But, I think Roland's right. I think Donald Trump motivates Democrats, hard left Democrats that are angry.
And motivates Republican primary voters.
Well, what I was going to say, though, is that most of these Democrats are people that can afford to be offended. They're in places like Simsbury, Guilford, and
New Haven,
Westport.
New Haven.
Well, but New Haven's never—it's never been a stronghold of. Republicans aren't going to win New Haven, right?
But so if Ned Lamont and Susan Bice, which are the ticket people on the Democratic side, are very worried, you're not going to get that 21,000 votes out of New Haven.
But that's on.
They're
going
to have to say Trump
but
to get that vote.
My point is he is 100% right. Donald Trump motivates Democrats. Dan Malloy motivates everybody else, which includes unaffiliated voters who cannot stand where the state is right now. And there's a fundamental shift within the Democratic Party. There's this really hard left group that's organized with Josh Elliott, and they are turning hard left in order to satisfy those anti-Trump grassroots activists in order to win.
Give me an example of what you're calling a hard left position.
Josh Elliott.
Give me a position.
I think
they're for that you consider so out.
Josh Elliott is essentially a socialist. Stuff. I mean, he's
No, forget the name calling. Universal.
No, that's not a name calling. Am I wrong?
Give me a position. Because Donald Trump was for universal health care before he wasn't.
Why? Josh Elliott has talked about raising $15 minimum wage.
That's hard left.
That's a motivating factor for a lot of these groups. And
but
for a lot of people,
hard left to pay people who haven't gotten raises with the cost of living for years to be able to afford to pay their
First of all, $15 an hour doesn't help someone get out of poverty. Let's be honest, right? If the goal.
So you want to pay them less? It's hard.
No,
I'm just saying
time
you're calling
out.
That
Wait,
hard.
You're not
a socialist hard
you
left.
You got to let me finish before you interrupt so I can and get the full point out, right? So $15 an hour, if the goal is to help someone out of poverty, it doesn't get you there. What we should be doing is actually looking at government and investing in a program that takes an adult who's currently working under minimum wage and set them on a path to prosperity and a career. $15 an hour doesn't get you a mortgage. It doesn't get you a college savings account. It doesn't get you a brighter future. All it does is put a little bit more money in your pocket so you feel a little bit more comfortable until all the prices rise. And that is the fundamental problem
you've raised a lot of questions there that are very legitimate, a lot of points. But bottom line, there's still a lot of people who work in fast food places and other service places who are choosing between, can't afford health care, are choosing between paying rent. In New Haven neighborhoods, sometimes it's 48% of people who are called food insecure, choosing between rent
Absolutely.
Or a meal. $40 a week would make a huge difference.
But it won't, because the prices of the food will rise. because everything rises when you raise minimum wage.
Wages are a small component of overall cost structures. And you look at fast food markets, they actually, you know, look at Walmart and McDonald's and other large corporations who actually have gone and increased their bottom line, their wages, is because they recognize that the wage base of their product cost is actually a very small proportion of the determinant value. So, like, you know, a $1 value meal cheeseburger doesn't go up $3 because someone got a wage increase of $3. So the reality is we have a period of slow job growth, but increasing economic inequality. We have a series of productivity gains in which incomes are not being realized by folks making 80% and below of the overall wages in our country.
But wages are rising across the country except they're not here.
Very, very slowly, while actual profit gains by corporations have seen dramatic growth. And while income inequality is rising, you're seeing almost none of that translate into wage growth at the lower economic
levels. Ron, I'm glad that you brought up corporations, because the truth of the matter is corporations love a higher minimum wage because it puts mom and pops out of business. It puts their competitors out of business.
That's been very much debated among studies about what actually happened when you raise
when you raise a minimum wage, Walmart has the cash liquidity to afford it. McDonald's has the cash liquidity and the mobility to adjust
pricing. I'm trying to catch up with some of these comments. Harry, do you think you can help me see some of the other ones? Julia Gouge writes in, JR's faux populism is laughable, trying to push hard left. JR's talking about this mural. We're not going to demonstrate a steam alliance because of a dead artist. I'm not sure what that means. She's with Gary Winfield, and was he in run with Eva Bermudez? And I'm sorry, how do I get to this other page?
We're generating a lot of comments.
That's good. Joanne, that's good.
Eller,
a lot of traffic.
Says liberals don't listen. God, please listen. Seth L. Poole says Mr. Bass's candor
Love
is
Seth.
Appreciated. Eric Mastriani says hello all. He's a Republican who runs for office, regular listener. Joanne Ellen
running against me, actually.
Says Walmart is pretty good at what they do without unions. Actually, can I just interject something here? Wasn't it unions and liberal Democrats you like to call socialists who said Walmart should pay the state back for all the public health benefits paid to their workers because they don't pay them enough?
Well, but again, we're...
You could be for that, right?
Well, there. No, but I think that there's a difference between the idea of what is a minimum wage job, right? Is it a career or is it a job that you start at to move up, right? So those are all those questions that fundamentally need to be answered, because I don't believe a minimum wage job is a career. I think we should be setting adults on a better path. And I think you would agree with me on that. And I don't think raising the minimum wage is the answer to getting people out of poverty. If that's the goal, raising minimum wage does not accomplish that goal, right?
And raising minimum wage allows people to buy food, to have secure housing while they are advancing in whatever field they're trying to advance in. You have to recognize the amount of time.
True.
This antiquated notion in the 70s and 80s of what minimum wage jobs are is no longer true in 2018. A minimum wage job holder is oftentimes a single female head of household, oftentimes with children at home. That is who is making
minimum
wage. So,
Roland, you're telling
me
you wouldn't want to get her a job that's paying her $40 an hour?
Of course we would.
Okay, well, why aren't we fundamentally talking about that?
Why is it one or the other, JR?
And because oftentimes they're using these jobs going to college, while they're taking classes at Gateway Community College or Manchester Community College.
But again, what I was explaining, though, raising the minimum wage, if raising the minimum wage actually accomplished what you believe, why is that Connecticut's income gap is growing or California's income gap is growing? Because fundamentally, raising the minimum wage does not accomplish the goal that you believe it does. It statistically does not. All you have to do is look at the states that have the highest minimum wage, and they have the highest income, gap.
That's generally because they have the highest income earners in the country as well. The number of billionaires in each of the three states you've identified are vastly higher than those in most other states across the country.
That wouldn't be the case, Roland, because you have billionaires in other states. But fundamentally, for example, Oklahoma has billionaires, right? So statistically,
I think per capita Connecticut is number one or number two.
No, but billionaires. My point is from a population standpoint, if you were to take our state compared to another state that's our size, that is a quote unquote red state with a lower minimum wage, the gap is smaller, is my point. And so I guess what I'm saying is if I think you and I can agree that our job, our fundamental job, is to find an opportunity for people so that they're not food insecure. Raising minimum wage does not accomplish that goal.
What the Republicans have done food stamps? You're worried about these people food insecure? I have family members on food stamps. You cannot get a fresh vegetable after the 10th
I think we have, the only thing that I think in terms of food stamps is we have to become a little bit more efficient in monitoring abuse. But I think we absolutely
need... documented to be more than a half or 1%?
No, I think it's probably around 10%.
Wow, that's a huge number. I think every study has indicated that like the amount of abuse or illegal activity, whatever the word is you want to use, is like hovers around 1% to 2% at the most.
What do you consider abuse, by the way?
I know everyone I've known on food stamps, I know that they're trying to get a fresh vegetable.
I'm saying, what would you consider something that's abuse?
If someone doesn't really qualify for the income.
Right, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about someone that takes a food stamps and sells it on the black market.
You're talking about the case in the Hill, like where the restaurant owner is buying all the junkies food stamps. Yeah, stuff like
that. What I'm saying is that fundamentally someone is misusing what's appropriate for the purpose of it.
Nobody's for fraud.
But
do you really think that would take care of raising it enough so that people can eat healthful diets on food stamps?
No, first of all, I never said anything about eliminating or cutting anything from anyone. I think we have to get a little bit more efficient in stamping out fraud and abuse, which again doesn't necessarily mean that to the point of is like someone that fraudulently gets a hold of food stamp, but someone who may qualify but then uses it for drug abuse or uses it for some other purpose that it's not meant for. And so I think we just have to get a little better at that because fundamentally
raise taxes so we have a regulatory state that can really crack down on people do things wrong, but let's also pay enough for food stamps.
But wait a minute. We, as a taxpayer, we're obligated to report every dime and dollar that I earn, right? And if we don't, we can get in trouble with the IRS. We can go to jail.
Is President Trump ever going to report the dollars that he's earned?
He certainly reports it to the IRS.
Is he going to report it to the public?
Well, he's obligated to report it to the IRS.
So JR and I end up agreeing on a lot. Ultimately, do I think minimum wage is the way we're going to build our economic future in the state of Connecticut? And that's what's going to have people buying homes and sending their kids to college? Of course not. JR and I agree with that. I think when you first asked me, what do we ask these Republican candidates and Democratic candidates generally? Paint a picture of 2025. Talk to me about how a minimum wage job is the bridge to you getting a college education that the Republican Party has undercut UConn and state universities. Across
the
board,
$300
million they took out of UConn's budget last year. We had to fight to put it back in. They recognized the error of their ways, and they actually voted for a new budget that restored those dollars. Yes, minimum wage isn't the answer to economic stability for our masses, but it is the bridge that we need while people are putting their lives together and going off to college.
And Eric Mastriani is agreeing with both of you. Minimum wage jobs, I believe, are training wages till they've gone to bigger and better things. But y'all got to let you respond to Roland's dig he put in there about UConn.
Well, I love that the idea, once again, Connecticut doing its best. UConn has the highest administrative cost in the country, meaning the cost to run UConn is the most expensive in the country because of what we pay our state employees that work at UConn. And so fundamentally what we're asking kids is to take hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt so that Susan Herbst can live in a nice house.
So do you disagree with your party for voting for the budget?
Is we have to be honest about UConn and how they're spending the money instead of giving them a blank check. And the reality is we're asking kids to go into massive debt so that professors can have a $120,000 a year pension so that a president who should be raising money from alumni, instead of going on a media tour bashing cuts that she may have, instead of pulling herself up and saying, I'm going to go call Jim Calhoun, I'm going to go call Gino Armenta, I'm going to do a fundraiser to fill that hole. And this is the problem that I have when we talk about education in this context. The college education system in the network in Connecticut is massively overbloated with administrators that are not helping kids.
Joanne
That's
Eiler
a fact.
Says UConn has their hand out constantly. Roland?
We have decreased support to the University of Connecticut over the last 20 years, while simultaneously they have improved their academic standing, their academic ratings, the number of graduates, the number of people they take out of places like New Haven, Hartford, Bridgeport, Stanford, Meriden. They're doing a much better job at keeping kids who, first-generation students who go to UConn now than they did 20 years ago. They've made remarkable improvements in the quality of education you receive on
that
campus.
Is that addressing J.R.'s point about administrative overhead?
You know what? You know what an administrative overhead is in his mind? Someone who actually sits down with a first-generation student and works them through the challenges that they're facing that no one in their family could have helped them with. Yes, that person's an administrator who's making $60,000 a year, but they contribute millions of dollars back into our communities by keeping those kids in college and ensuring the investment that we're making in them is realized
so
in future years.
But Roland, here's the fundamental problem. The cost of tuition is rising and the amount of money they're demanding from us is rising. So at what point do we say, this is enough? Because the rate that we're going, and by the way, it's not just UConn. The college system in Connecticut is massively overbloated. In fact, there's been several scandals around how much they're giving each other raises. They're doing all this stuff. It is not this great. UConn has done a tremendous job. I think it's ranked 28th or something like that in 18. Agricultural schools. But we have to make an evaluation as what's happening in other places of the state. Our economy is shrinking. We are one of, I think, two states in the entire country that has lost jobs in the last 3 months.
Do we shrink more by not investing in infrastructure or higher ed?
So it's a race to the bottom, right? So the issue is that if we're losing population and we're losing jobs now, investing hundreds of billions of dollars into a college system, and there's nothing here for these kids when they get out anyway.
Roland?
And that's true, by the way.
It isn't a race to the bottom to invest in our transportation network and in our public universities and in our primary educational facilities. Look, that is the way we get out of this. There are huge
employers. So more money from taxpayers.
There are huge employers in the state of Connecticut who are willing to grow, who want to grow, who are, in fact, growing. They made huge multi-thousand-person commitments in Hartford and Eastern Connecticut. You see what were happening in health care and education along.
Are you talking about Electric Boat?
Electric Boat.
Thank God for federal military contracts.
Insurance companies coming into Hartford. Look, if you don't like the 3,000 new employees that are going to have in Eastern Connecticut, I would love to see the Republican Party go out there.
No, but let's just be honest why they're there. They're not there because of anything Connecticut did.
I wish you guys were debating tonight. Joseph Massaro says Connecticut's in a recession, which I don't think is factually accurate.
It is.
Oh, it is?
Yeah. We're losing jobs. I mean,
it is not factually accurate. A term recession has an actual definition, and we do not meet the criteria.
It's the Democrats need to own it. 11% tax increase in New Haven, which New Haven says is because the state has not been living up to its obligation under payments in lieu of taxes program.
Oh, God, I can't. I'm struggling with the 11% tax increase in New Haven as well. I think it puts us in an economically uncompetitive area.
But you know what
area.
I hear from the people who have been studying, the independent commission studying from SOM, Learn Belly SOM guy in New Haven finances? They said that our effective tax rate in New Haven, it's actually 25% lower than that in Hartford and Bridgeport. And that
I can honestly say New Haven is not that I agree with 11% tax increase, it's generally run better than.
Yeah, so they're saying that if we do have some kind of structural problems, they're going to need a state bailout. The state will actually want New Haven to raise its taxes more before it's going to ask state taxpayers to pony up.
And that whole Hartford deal was a joke, by the way. I mean.
What do you think, Roland? Talking about the $50 million bailout.
The picking up of some of their long-term bonding obligations. Look, cities are in the position they are in because we are perfectly laid out for 1818, not 2018. The idea that we need 104 different 911 call centers and 131 different boards of education and 169 independent towns, all of them with their own superfluous administrative bloat and overhead, like a lot of that could be regionalized to save extraordinary dollars. That's where hundreds of millions of dollars in savings comes from. The idea that you need a deputy director of X, Y, and Z in every single town across the state of Connecticut is absurd.
But
and
Rowan, those other towns aren't bankrupt.
They're going to be. More and more towns are feeling this fiscal stress. You're seeing actual towns in Eastern Connecticut who, like, we have to consolidate. We might go bankrupt. We don't know what to do. You've actually seen that, not in the cities, but in the smaller
rural
towns.
State Republican Chairman Roland Lamar, state rep, Democrat from New Haven. We have a few minutes left. Tell me if I'm right about this. I think actually the most interesting race this year, the one that's really going to define the future of our state is the lieutenant governor race in each party. I think at least the primary season, the August 14th primary, you have on the Republican side Joe Markley, who is one of my favorite people in Hartford. He's a very intelligent, compassionate guy who's as far right wing as anyone in government.
Yes.
And just a really decent human being, running against Erin Stewart, who's young enough to be his daughter, who he and others feel are not a real Republican because she has raised taxes in New Britain. She's for abortion rights. And
what Republicans do you future, talk to? I'm just curious.
Future. And then on the Democratic side, you have Susan Bisewitz, who was nominated by the party, and this groundswell of people for the challenger. Roland, you're going against your own party leaders. You've supported Eva Bermudez Zimmerman to run against her. And again, it's like in the 5th District. I forgot to bring this up. The Democrats had a superstar. They have like a next Obama Teacher of the Year. And they don't give her the nomination. They give it to Mary Glassman, another retread. So I'm wondering whether we're seeing in the lieutenant governor races the same dynamic, the future versus the past. Weighing in on that in each race?
Well, I think that there is some irony to, and I actually got very upset with a reporter who tried to compare Erin to Eva, because there's no comparison. Aaron is the mayor of a very large city, has a track record of basically fixing a city's economy.
Wait, they're both around the same age. They both have a lifetime of public service.
They're not comparable.
But you know what's interesting, JR? You're talking now about Eva versus Aaron. Is that because you believe they're going to be the candidates? Because neither of them was the party candidate. Not at all.
But I'm saying in terms of, you talked about youth. There's no comparison between the two. Aaron has accomplished a tremendous amount.
One's 31, the other's 31.
No, but that's the only thing that's comparable. Right.
Right. Aaron's dad was a mayor of the town, an elected official in that town before she ran for office in her own right. And Ava was an original plaintiff in the Sheff versus O'Neill that highlighted the incredible inequities in school financing across the state of Connecticut that got numerous lawsuits settled on behalf of her
students. Why are you going against your party leadership, Roland, and backing Eva Bermudez Zimmerman?
Look, I think what our state needs is someone who can speak to and represent the future of Connecticut, which is not, you know, the self-financing millionaires or the, you know, backroom deals in town after town based upon relationships you may have had with somebody 20, 30 years ago. Ava represents what is
SCIU.
Happening. No,
she doesn't. What's her job?
She represents a growing number of folks who think the difference in Connecticut is investing in real places that are growing jobs, that are growing our populations.
Has she done that? Because Aaron has. Aaron actually brought back New Britain's economy. I'm just saying.
Which is why the Republicans
didn't want
her. It's
great to talk about.
Which, JR, is the reason you didn't want her to be the Republican candidate, because she did it.
Me? It has nothing to do with me. I didn't do anything.
Your party. She had to raise taxes to do it.
No, listen, because she had a $30 million budget deficit that was left there by the Democrat council and the Democrat mayor. Yes, the city of New Britain was going, they actually told her to go bankrupt. She could have went
We had a $1.5 billion deficit in the state. Does that mean we shouldn't have raised taxes to do that?
Oh, no, but here's the thing. But she also made cuts. She made hard decisions in the city. She went through line by line and made the government more efficient.
So
she started.
Malloy had a revolt from Democratic constituents.
The caucuses do not agree with Malloy. They've been fighting for the last 2 years. I completely agree with that. I think there's a lot of problems with what the, and I'm not saying this of you, but I think particularly in the Senate, didn't want to do things that Malloy wanted to do.
So what happens if the party goes against you twice and has Lamont and Bisowitz as the ticket? How are you going to?
He'll be a good soldier.
I will be comfortable with the idea that Ned Lamont will be a fantastic governor when compared against anyone on the Republican side. Look, I think the reason why Donald Trump excites Democratic voters and gets them out to the polls is because they know everything is a threat. And if we do not have a Democratic governor who reflects our values, reflects who we are as a state, we know that we lose advancements that we've made on civil rights, on social rights, education, healthcare, and access to
that's just
health.
Delusional. That is. I mean, Congresswoman DeLauro had made a comment about what's happening with some of the children. She does this big press conference, but it was happening under the Obama administration. She actually calls for Trump to be a dictator and essentially create law out of nothing, which is the fundamental problem, which is what we don't want. And that's why I think it's so ironic when you listen to Democrats talk about the threats and the risk and other, when there's a public policy that doesn't exist. It's rhetoric. And at the end of the day, what I can say is that families in this state are suffering because the policies that the Democratic Party in Hartford have pushed. We're losing jobs. It's costing us more to live here. We are insolvent. I mean, we're $1 billion with unfunded liability. That is all right,
folks,
the hardworking families are
running out of time. You got a taste of what Democrats and Republicans are going to be saying on the campaign trail on this very busy election year. Tonight, Monday night, the Schubert Theater, 7 o'clock and live on Channel 8. You're going to see the Republican candidates for governor. I want to thank J.R. Romano, State Republican Chairman and Democratic State Rep Roland Lamar of New Haven, untitled man behind the scenes of many campaigns, for giving us the debate we really deserve. Because, guys, you guys are great.
Thank you.
I hope you come back and do it again. Thank you, everyone. I'm sorry we didn't get to all your comments on Facebook to read on the air, but thank you very much for listening. We're going to take it out with the Afro-Semitic Experience performing I Wish I Knew How It'd Feel to Be Free from the group CD, A Plea for Peace, and the Dobro playing you heard at the beginning with some Stacey Phillips, the Grammy-winning New Haven Dobro player who died last week of a heart attack. Yesterday, they had a wonderful, wonderful day-long concert in his memory at Cafe 9. They played this song, and they had Stacey's Dobro player part played on clarinet by Will Bartlett, and we'll never forget that one. But anyway, we all know what it's like to be free. We just got to remember to book our flight. Fly free with us all day and all night long here at WNHH. New Haven's home for community radio.